Hey, nurses. Welcome to the Nurse Dot Podcast, giving nurses validation, resources, and hope one episode at a time. Today on Nurse Dot Podcast,
we don't need to build trust. You can't build something that someone else gives you, right? So rather than building trust, we need to earn trust. The reality is that there's a power differential. And if we don't acknowledge the power differential and put ourselves in a position of being accessible and available and thoughtful, then patients won't trust us because they're trusting us with their most precious resource, their lives.
Joining us today for part one of a two-part episode is Dr. Rob McDermott. As someone who is a celebrated TEDx speaker and has worked in intensive care for decades, Rob explores the delicate art of medicine and how it balances against the science.
I'm your host, Kara Lunsford, registered nurse and VP of community at nurse.com.
Well, Rob McDermott, it's nice to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. You know, I'm really looking forward to having this conversation with you. We started a long time ago, but today's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So, Rob, Dr. Rob, I'd love for you to tell me just a little bit about yourself, a little bio, so that the audience knows who you are and what you do, and maybe a little bit of like how you came to be really like fascinated more, I think, by the art of medicine.
Sure. My name is Rob McDermott. I'm a intensive care physician at a hospital in British Columbia, Canada called Surrey Memorial Hospital. I did my training quite a long time ago. I trained in Edmonton, Alberta to be a respirologist and intensivist. And I finished my training back in 2003. I also did a fellowship in cardiac ultrasound because I felt that that was going to be a very important part of critical care in the future. And I had the good fortune of being part of the early development of critical care ultrasound for very sick patients. Since 2003, I've been practicing as an intensivist. And how I kind of fell into this is it was often on holiday when people heard that I was effectively a life support specialist. What my job entails is putting people who are very sick on machines and using machines and technology to keep them alive when their bodies would otherwise die. And so people don't often get to see death and dying in their lives other than maybe a partner, maybe a parent, and certainly not more than a couple of times. But over my career, the statistics show that about 1 in 6 people in the ICU die. And that means that when I'm looking after 15 to 20 patients a week, I see death quite frequently. And I don't know if that makes me an expert, but it gives me familiarity with the process of dying. And it's allowed me to be with families in a way that most people don't get to be. So this closeness to death and this closeness to, bridging the gap between life and death means that I have this opportunity to connect with people in a way that a lot of other people don't. And so when I was on holiday, you know, people would ask me about my job and I'd say, oh, you know, I'm an ICU doctor. And the people would be like, oh, so what does that mean? And I say, well, you know, one of the things that I see a lot of is death and dying. And people stop and they just don't know how to approach it. And then they start asking little questions about what does that mean? Like, so what is it like? And how can you do that? And to me, I found that what the conversation around death and dying is a doorway into what matters to people. When you're dealing with a limited time for yourself or with other people that you care about, things become really clear really quickly. And so I had this great opportunity to connect with people, with families, and I felt that was really where the value was, because what I've come to learn is also that I don't have the tools or the skill to save life all the time, right? It's a lot of what happens in the ICU is the determinants of whether someone will live or die are there long before I get to see them. But what I can have a very powerful impact on is the journey that people take and the experience that they have while the events of their illness unfold. Certainly my goal is to try to help people survive. But what I can have a very powerful impact on is how that experience unfolds. And so I've taken to understand that there's a lot of uncertainty in medicine, even though we call it a science, and that the art part of it, which is the creating an emotional experience that is safe and caring and kind of satisfying as well as safe, is really important for people. If I can't affect the outcome, I can affect the journey, and you can turn this really horrible, difficult experience that people are having into something that is a transcendent legacy that they remember forever in a way that allows them to have post-traumatic growth. It's always traumatic, but sometimes you can grow from it because you've had an experience that allows you to integrate the experience into your life. So that's how I came to it. And I also have the good fortune of being a hospital administrator. I was the medical director for a pretty large hospital, 600-bed hospital for 6 years. And I tried to embrace that art part of medicine as part of my practice. And now I have another administrative position where I'm in charge of a medical advisory committee for a health authority of about 2 million people. So my role is to provide advice to the CEO of the organization and the board of directors about how do we do medicine, right? How do we practice medicine in a way that is safe, compassionate, effective, and all that. So it's a lovely opportunity for me to speak what I believe. And I think one of the things that we're missing in medicine right now is a focus on that experience. I think that art part, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, I'm sure, but the art part of medicine is what people really want. You can't not deal with the science stuff. You can't be a quack.
Right.
You have to be good technically at what you do. But if you don't do the art part, people don't feel cared for, then you're not doing your job. Right? We're in a healing specialty. We're in a caring specialty, both you and I. And if we don't do that caring part, then the technical stuff doesn't land.
Absolutely.
So that's how I got to where I am.
I love it. It's something that if you have, like what you said, if you've worked in end of life, in death and dying, you know that I have as well. So I worked in pediatric oncology most of my career. I would even venture to say all of my career, because I have had home patients, private patients, clear up until very recently, for 17 years. So it's 100% about having that part cannot not exist, because I would venture to say that there is no healing, there is no wellness really, when you don't incorporate that into your practice. And I don't think we look at it as much as we should be looking at it, about how somebody does when they have that kind of support, they have that type of caring, they have people that are in the room, sitting down with them, taking time, holding space, doing all of these things that really do affect the outcome of their disease. And
100%.
100%, right? It's like, and like you said so beautifully, the outcome of their disease may be death, but the quality of that journey, the quality of that passing, is heavily dependent on the practitioners who embrace this art. So I'm so curious, like, as you've worked as a hospital administrator, how have you seen adoption of this or the rollout of this? Because I'm sure other administrators, other people are listening to this podcast and they're going, we need more of that in our hospital. We need more of that support. We need a chief medical officer that supports that.
You know, there's a couple of things that come to mind when you ask that question. The first is that we struggle in medicine for a couple of reasons. One, we pretend to deal with certainty, right? We want to predict what's going to happen. We want to know who's coming to the hospital. We want to know what they've got. We want to know what tests are going to be necessary. We want certainty about, and then we want certainty of outcome. One of the challenges with certainty is that it doesn't leave a lot of room for hope, right? If you know what's going to happen, there's nothing to hope for. If you know what's not going to happen, there's also nothing to hope for. It's the uncertainty that actually brings into the equation the possibility of something that you aren't confident of, right? And that's where hope, that's the well from which hope springs, in my opinion. Now, the real challenge is that with certainty, there's another very powerful motivator, which is efficiency. And being efficient in healthcare is important because we know it's hard to get in to see practitioners sometimes. In Canada, we're having a lot of problems with that right now because of human resource shortages and doctor shortages. But I think the focus on efficiency means that people are rushing. And if we know that, what we know very clearly from the data is that if people are task-oriented and hurried, it's not that they're not compassionate. It's that their ability to be aware of suffering, of things that they're not focused on, is very limited. And so it's not that they're willfully ignoring people when they're busy. It's that they actually, it doesn't even enter their consciousness because they're not paying attention to the signs that someone might need attention, right? Themselves. They're not paying attention to the signals that say, hey, I need to pause here because I'm being held accountable for X, Y, and Z, right? These are the tasks that I need to finish. And so to come back to your question, what have I seen? I've seen it be very difficult to embed, right, in terms of an organizational practice. What it really is, in my opinion, is a way of being, right? And so the only way to create that is really through through modeling, role modeling, right? So you have to, at the top, be demonstrating this ability to pause. And then you have to build the infrastructure around it that allows those pauses to happen when they're most important. Now, the downside is you don't want, you know, your doctor spending 8 hours with you when you don't need it. And two, there's a whole bunch of other patients waiting. But to be able to create the space for the pause when it's necessary, I think is super important. And in fact, if we don't do that, I think medicine in general is at risk, because what people come to the hospital for, what people go to healthcare for, is to be cared for. Right. There's some legislation in Canada where if I'm not mistaken, I hope it's changed. I haven't looked at the legislation for a while, but it refers to people who work in our profession as health professionals. They've actually omitted the word care, right? Which is shocking. Like, we're not healthcare professionals, we're health professionals. So I thought to myself, wow, like if our legislation missed that part, then how do we change the infrastructure and the incentives and the remuneration and all of that stuff that obviously matters, but is really peripheral. We're supposed to be doing this stuff to enable the care that's necessary, and yet we haven't really built the right structure to do it.
That's so profound, by the way.
I'm not certain.
So profound. I mean, the fact that you were like, they took out the word care. I mean, that's...
I don't know if they took it out or if they never included it, right? Either way, it's still like mind-boggling. So I think that one of the most important thing that I think we can do is model the behavior. Right. And so people with some positional authority need to say, hey, paying attention to what matters to patients is important for our providers to do. And I think the things that we hold people accountable for, showing up to meetings, you know, doing charting, all of these things are very important. But when there is a patient need, somehow we need to give people a pass. As long as they're not socially loafing, right? You're not avoiding work that's necessary by saying, oh, I'm going to spend it with my patient, right? The looking after the patient is the work, and all of these other things are supposed to be empowering the healthcare professionals to be able to do that work. So in my opinion, I think one of the big things we have to do with every intervention in healthcare is figure out, when we do something, how do we drive more time to the patient's bedside? If we can drive more time for providers to be able to be at the patient's bedside, then we'll win, because the being at the bedside is the thing that actually allows people to make connections and to have that experience of being cared for and for caring for people. So that's how I see it.
Yeah, that's how we address so much of what we talk about on a regular basis, which is moral injury. Moral injury really is like when you, and I've said this ad nauseum on this podcast, so any listeners are going to be like, we know what it is. But for anyone who hasn't listened before, you know, that when you cannot do the job that you signed up to do, And you can't do it safely. You can't do it ethically. You can't do it morally. You know, you are up against all of these things, and you can't take care of yourself, and you can't take care of other people. It is something that will strip away at your soul. And I do feel like when your administrators, when your managers or your directors or whoever it is shows that they care about you, then you can then do the job that you signed up to do, which is to care for other people. I mean, you signed up for that. That's why you're doing the job that you're doing. Nobody goes into nursing or to be a physician because they love sitting in front of a computer and charting and like that. That's not what we signed up for. We understand that's part of the job. But if it becomes all of the job and none of it is what makes you feel like you're making a difference in the world or making a difference in the lives of people, then there's no sustainability. You will continue to see nurses leave and physicians leave, and that's going to continue to happen. And I feel like there's things that could be done that are, they're not hard things to do. Like I used to say, okay, at the beginning of my shift, I'm going to sit down with my patient. I'm just going to sit. I'm either going to sit on their bed, I'm going to sit in the chair next to them, but I'm going to sit down. And even if I just spend a few minutes, it doesn't have to be hours. If I spend a few minutes at the beginning of the shift showing that I'm taking an interest in you as a human being, you as a person, to learn a little bit about you, to learn how was your night, or what are you thinking is going to unfold today, or what would you like to see happen today, and what kind of goals are you trying to meet? Do you have family at home? For when you are discharged, let's talk a little bit about that. Like, what's the support that you have or don't have? Taking an interest, but sitting down, not hovering over people, not standing over them and looking like you're ready to turn around and walk out the door. So, I mean, do you feel like, Rob, that there's some things, like some easy lift things that you implement on a daily basis or have throughout your career that you feel like maybe seem like small things or don't take a lot of time, but have a big impact?
Absolutely. So I do a few little things in my practice. Whenever I'm talking to someone, I either sit or I lean against a wall. It creates the, I'll say illusion. It's not an illusion. Like it creates the impression that I have all the time in the world, right? I want to appear approachable. I want to appear like I'm committed completely. So I assume some kind of relaxed posture intentionally. I allow people to call me by my first name. Right? And I've been doing medicine a long time. And so if someone doesn't recognize my positional authority, I actually don't care anymore. Right? It's like, I remember a patient that I was looking after who I had his wife in the room while we were putting him on life support. And I had some trainees with me. And so because I had trainees, I was supervising, but I was sitting in the back of the room watching everything going on. And I was talking with his wife and just chatting about what was happening. I had a resident with me who was physically very large. He was about 6'5" and he was like 230, 240 pounds. So just a giant of a person. And I had another trainee who had very gray hair. And even though I'm 52, I don't have much gray hair and I don't color. It's just fortunate for me right now. So I looked like the youngest person in the room. And the woman looked at me while I was, and she was just chatting with me about her husband. We actually put him on life support, but just before we put him on life support, I excused myself for a moment because he said, "Oh, I'm so cold." And I went and got him a warm blanket from a blanket warmer. And I kind of tucked him in while we were getting ready to put him on life support. And for me, that was actually one of the most meaningful things I did all day because I actually did something that was caring for him. But after we'd finished putting him on life support, his wife turned to me and said, "You know, that was a really nice thing that you did. And, you know, I really appreciate you getting him the blanket. When are you going to be a real doctor? Right? When do you get to be a real doctor?" So she thought I was a medical student or something. I don't know what she thought it was. But I said, I hate to break it to you, but I'm actually the doctor in charge of all of his care. And she said, "What?" And I said, "I'll tell you something else. I'm actually the medical director of this entire hospital." I never tell people that, but I thought it was so funny that she thought I was a medical student. And so I actually shared that I was the medical director for the hospital at the same time. She said, "Oh, you get out of here." Right. And it was so funny to have that experience of doing this thing that his wife felt was insignificant from a medical standpoint, but in my opinion, it was actually the pivotal thing that made him feel comfortable while we were doing all of this other stuff and resonated with her as a person watching the care being delivered, right? It was a bit of an unusual experience of the thing that I thought was necessary was the thing that was completely non-medical. It was a very serious situation, but it wasn't even perceived as part of medicine, which I thought was very, it was satisfying to do, but I thought, wow, like these are the things that we need to incorporate. We need to consider the person that we're doing this stuff to, and shift it from doing it to them to doing it for them and with them. So I really believe in that kind of dialogue. I think that's one of the things I always ask. I look to see if they're cold. I take a relaxed posture. I try to get a warm blanket. Sometimes I buy people, like in the ICU, we don't often have people that aren't intubated, right? So they're almost always on a ventilator. But if someone's able to swallow, which sometimes they aren't, and doesn't have a tube in, I often ask them if they want a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or, you know, something to eat if the meal trays have gone by. And I'll go down to our, you know, Starbucks or Second Cup or whatever, and I'll go buy them something to eat if the meal trays have gone by, because it's something kind of, you know, generous to do, and it makes me feel good and they feel like they're being cared for. So I make that a part of my routine practice. And then the other things that I do in my routine practice are when you're admitted to an intensive care unit, your family goes through an emotional roller coaster. And I know not a lot of doctors do this, but I feel like families need a lot of communication, right? Not everybody has time to speak to families every day. But if a family is in the room, I always, assuming, you know, my day isn't getting completely blown out of the water by people who are extraordinarily sick, and if my attention isn't being forcibly dragged elsewhere, if I see a family in the room, I always acknowledge them. So I give them just 1 or 2 minutes of my time, because they are waiting for some kind of sign from their doctor that things are okay or not okay. It's just this emotional roller coaster. And so I make it a practice that if the family is in the room, I say hello. If I don't have time, I actually say, "I'm sorry, I don't have time to talk, but today is going okay, right? And I'll talk with you tomorrow." And that practice of actually just touching base briefly to say, "Hey, I see you there. I understand how stressful this is for you. And I want to give you information. All you need to know is that today I'm not worried, or I'm less worried than I was yesterday." And that's usually enough to carry things forward. I do put a lot of time in with families up front, because one of my jobs is to engender a relationship. I have to create a relationship with people very quickly when they meet me. It's a very serious situation that they find themselves in, and I have to create a relationship with them for them to be able to trust me to do the things that are required for their loved ones, up to and including allowing them to die comfortably. And I have to build that rapport very quickly. So
yes,
Three things I need to do. Yeah, it's amazing. The three things you need to do is you need to be honest, reliable, competent, and then the catalyst for building that, being trustworthy, is that you're compassionate. So that's the practice of me going into the room, me being available, me being reliable, following up on what I say I'm going to do, and just being accessible. And so sometimes the first name helps. Other times people just want to refer to me as doctor. That's okay. I always try to address some kind of physical need in the room. And I acknowledge what the person needs and what the family needs to the best of my ability, trying to create time and space for that.
Mental health matters. Become a master's prepared psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner at Nightingale College. If you are an RN with a bachelor's degree in nursing, you can take the next step in a rewarding career move where you'll develop advanced knowledge and skills in assessment, intervention, and management within the construct of the psychiatric mental health patient-provider relationship. and patient-centered care across the lifespan. This CCNE-accredited program is now taking applications for the fall 2025 semester. For more information, please visit nightingale.edu or call 801-689-2160, because mental health matters. Yeah, and all of those things don't have to take a long time. Like, to your point, it's like that can all be done in minutes. It really in minutes.
Absolutely.
And so I know sometimes I hear nurses, I hear doctors say, you know, I just don't have time. I just don't have time. And I understand. I've worked at the bedside. I know what it's like when you're short-staffed, when you're trying to, you know, check the boxes, trying to just get the things done. You're like, okay, this person needs to go to CT. This person, I need to get these meds in. This person, these orders need to be signed, and this person's going to be discharged, and I have an admission coming later, and I know that the ED is going to call me. And there's all these things that are happening all at the same time. But at the same time, what I have tried to impress upon even nurses that I have precepted is I'm like, you won't believe how many call bells you will save yourself when you go in early. If you go in early and establish this early that, you know, I'm here, I've got you, I've got a lot of stuff to do today, but don't worry, I know exactly what's happening in your care, and let's take a second, let's review what your night was like and what you want to do today, which only sometimes takes just a few minutes. And I will tell you, it brings down the level of anxiety in those patients and in those family members, because sometimes it's not even the patient that's ringing the call bell. It's the family that's ringing.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of establishing that at the beginning of your shift can save you so much time throughout 12 hours if you're a nurse, or if you're a doctor, just being paged to the room again. So I'm hoping that people take away from like what you just said, all of these things that are what I would consider to be like low lifts. They're a low lift, but they mean so much. And you and I are both friends with Michael. I've interviewed him before on the podcast, and we've talked about how you have to establish these intimate relationships very quickly. And it comes from a sense of vulnerability. There's like, if they're in a really vulnerable situation and you come in and you don't have some element of vulnerability too, it's very hard to meet people where they are, to establish that. Like, they've been maybe sitting in the same clothes for like 3 days, haven't showered, you know, holding vigil over the bedside or something like that. And you know, to come in and to just be kind of humble in a way, but also carry with you a sense of, like you mentioned, being very competent. You know, they can trust in you. You carry this with you, but at the same time, you try to come down and meet them where they are.
Totally. Totally. So when one of the things that I hear a lot of people say is, and there's a great TED talk on it by I think she's an Irish philosopher named Honora O'Neill. She says, we don't need to build trust, right? Trust, you can't build something that someone else gives you, right? So rather than building trust, she says, we need to earn trust by behaving in a way that is trustworthy. And so it really puts the onus on us. Rather than me trying to convince someone to trust me, all I have to do is a behavior, which is behave in a way that is worthy of someone else's trust, and they will automatically trust you, right? So you have to be sincere in it, obviously. And like I said, the three elements are the competency, reliability, and honesty. And it's not about being nice. It's about being kind, right? Sometimes you have to share really difficult things, and being nice actually puts a veneer over top of it that actually interferes with what you what needs to happen. Sometimes we need to say very difficult things, but we say difficult things in a way that doesn't compound suffering. So by being kind in the way that we express things. And I also agree with you, meeting people where they are. You have to acknowledge that there's positional authority. You know, this isn't one of the big differences between medicine and the retail industry is that people don't really have a choice. They have a choice sometimes of which hospital they go to, but they get the nurse that they're assigned. They get the doctor that's there. If it's an emergency, they have limited choice. And certainly they're not choosing to be sick almost ever. Right. So the reality is that there's a power differential. And if we don't acknowledge the power differential and put ourselves in a position of being accessible and available and thoughtful, then patients won't trust us because they're trusting us with their most precious resource, their lives, right? And their well-being. So I totally agree with you that we need to be able to, and it's not really come down to their level. It's be at the same place as they are, meet them where they are. And if they haven't had a shower, I know it's like, you know what, you need to be able to look after you, right? And you say, if you need some time to just go and have something to eat, shower, clean up, because you feel like you need to, I'm here. Right, we'll look after the patient. I'll make sure I keep an eye on your husband, on your son, on your daughter, on the person that's in the bed. It's really for me, and you're probably getting this impression, and you know this from your experience in critical care, that I'm dealing with families as much as I'm dealing with patients. It's almost like a pediatric experience where the family is really a very important part of the overall care team. You can't look after the patient in a very effective way unless you understand the context in which you're looking after them. And that means knowing the people in the room, which are the family members. Most of my patients are unconscious and on ventilators and on life support. So I don't get to engage with them. When I do, I really enjoy it because, you know, then I get to, you know, engage with the person that's actually experiencing the physical and emotional suffering and see if I can do something about that. But the family experiences it temporally and emotionally. Right. And they also have their physical needs start to be a little bit peeled back. Like they don't sleep, they don't eat, they don't get to look after themselves. Jobs are obviously, people don't always get time off from work. If there's financial stresses, all of those things.
Yep.
And so I'm meeting them in this place where it's super, super stressful. And what they need to know is I've got their back, right? And I've got their loved ones back. And once someone trusts me to do what's right, my job becomes so easy. Right. It may be hard, but the stuff may be hard to do, but the journey becomes so much easier to navigate. And that's when the outcome becomes obviously very important, but a little bit less, the focus shifts from the outcome to the journey.
Yeah.
So if someone is going to die, we can make sure that the experience is solid and that the family trusts that I'm doing the right thing, even if the outcome isn't what they hope for. And I also need to know that I'm doing the right things. So it's restorative for me to have that experience because the moral injury that you talked about is alleviated in a big way when you are doing what you feel is morally right for someone, even when the person doesn't survive. And so that experience is very restorative for people.
Yeah.
I think the pandemic showed us that when you weren't with patients because you were wearing all the crap that we had to put on, all the PPE, people died from loneliness and healthcare care workers burnt out because the stuff that mattered, the being with people, was peeled away. We weren't allowed to. We couldn't do it. So it was so hard to communicate with people, so hard to be with patients, it was so hard to be with families. Families weren't allowed in the room. And I think that that experience really shattered a lot of the foundation of healthcare. Somehow we got to reclaim that. And I think we are clawing our way back to the way older ways of being, but with a new framing, right? We're not going back. We're moving forward, but recognizing the value of what we used to do pre-pandemic actually made a big difference. Holding someone's hand, being with them quietly saves lives. There is no question in my mind that art part that we talked about, that you mentioned, it saves people's lives because they relax. They don't fight. They don't get agitated. They start concentrating on the healing aspect of what is necessary for them to do. They sleep, they eat, they exercise, they trust their healthcare team. And hopefully they end up having, you know, restoration there. Their bodies have the capacity to heal from the terrible thing that happened to them, whatever that might be.
When you can get people to, when you can inspire them to all row in the same direction with you, and that means the families, the patient, the healthcare, you know, staff, because, you know, just getting everybody kind of on board and rowing in the same direction. And if they can't row in the same direction, at the very least, they just pull up their oar. Like they don't dig it in. They don't go the other way. At the very least, if you can get them to just lift the oar, because to what you were saying is this is a point in their lives, in these patients' lives, in these families' lives, that they just have no control. And I don't know many people that are comfortable being out of control.
Yeah.
And so it's just about you said this beautifully. It's like just saying out loud to people, like sometimes like there's this assumption, right? That, well, they know that I know that this is so hard. I'm like, no, do they though? So sometimes just saying, and I used to do this too with families. I'd say, you know, how many other kids do you have at home? And then they'd say, oh, you know, I have three kids, and, you know, and not only do I have three kids, but my mother lives with us and, you know, she's disabled, but I can't leave the bedside. I mean, I just can't leave. I mean, what am I going to do? Leave my child who has cancer. So I have some neighbors that have been helping me out, and I've got, you know, some church people that have been helping me out, but I don't know how long that's going to last. And all it took was me just asking a question, because now they know that I'm putting things together. So do you work from home, or are you the sole caregiver? Do you have another parent who helps, or, you know, are you both working outside the home? You just start to take an interest in their life, and you start to show that it is not lost on you that they are having to juggle a lot of other things aside from the fact that this person who is the most important person in their life, probably, or at least close to it, is battling something that could be life or death.
Absolutely.
And that everything else kind of has to take a back seat. But it doesn't mean that it's not weighing enormously on them. And so I think there's a little bit of that, of like, don't just make an assumption. Make sure you ask, even though you're like, oh God, if I ask these questions, you know, the patient's going to go on and I'm not going to be able to get out of the room and I don't know what I'm going to be, you know, it's like, I understand. Like sometimes you don't know, you know, how far that's going to go, but there are ways of being able to say, this is super important information that you're sharing. And I think we probably need to bring in a few different elements of the healthcare team so that we can help provide a really holistic approach. For you and the patient and your family. And so this is going to go on my list of things that I'm going to focus on today.
Yeah. I mean, you've obviously got lots of experience with managing teams, and that's a lot of what we do, right? Is managing teams, making sure the right people have the right information, having a family completely unload on you and then being responsible for managing that information packet is actually quite challenging. And you want the other team members involved because they have skills that I don't have. There's two things that came to mind. I want to use your line, getting comfortable being uncomfortable that's such a great line. I'm going to steal that. That's okay.
You can have it.
Cause it's absolutely what we need to be, being comfortable in situations where we are uncomfortable, just being able to tolerate that discomfort in a way that doesn't derail us is a super, super useful skill. The other thing that I've always been very mindful of in my practice is that your experience and my experience of the suffering that we see is very different. right? Your experience of suffering with a patient is a 12-hour shift or an 8-hour shift, depending on where you're working. But you're dealing with the suffering of a single person. You can't escape it. One of the things that doctors have the luxury of is, you know, I might see a patient, if I spend a long time with a patient, is 20 to 25 minutes. Like, that's a long time with a critically ill patient to spend with a family just chatting about things. Right? I might be doing things that take a lot longer in terms of the technical stuff, but to talk with someone for 20 minutes, that's, you know, people say that's unheard of, right? So I think that my experience of a patient suffering in terms of its temporal length, like 20 minutes versus 12 hours, that is a completely different experience. And I can't imagine what it would be like for a nurse at the bedside to not have the physician who is in charge of the care plan not acknowledge the suffering. So one of the things that I'm very mindful of is to make sure that I'm supporting the rest of my team in being able to manage the suffering. And you spoke about having everybody rowing in the same direction, making sure that if the team members are experiencing moral distress or having trouble with the care plan, knowing that I'm supporting them in their journey of illness as well, because they're having this vicarious suffering of watching someone who is in their charge have pain, have suffering, emotionally go through an emotionally very traumatic experience, and the family as well, right? So by supporting my team in their journey, then you can help the family heal even more effectively, because you appear to be a unified, part of a greater whole. I think that's also very important from an administrative standpoint. You really want to create this impression of continuity. And there's kind of three experiences of continuity when we're talking about care. There's this kind of relational continuity, where you have a person that you know as your nurse or your doctor, so the relationships exist over time. You have informational continuity, where you're taking the stuff from the past and you're bringing it into the present so that you can try to plan for the future. Right? And then there's this managerial continuity, which sometimes healthcare doesn't do very well. The feeling like all of the component parts are part of a greater machine or of an initiative or of a practice that is moving forward in a cohesive way. You can tease apart those three elements when you look at how continuity of care works. And that's one of the things that I try to focus on. In an emergency department, you really are talking about relational continuity, because the person needs to feel safe. When you're having transitions of care, you're looking for informational continuity, because when you go from one team to another, you fracture the relationship, and you have to actually have information being carried forward so it feels like there's still something connecting the two. And when someone shows up and says, I don't even know why I'm here, right? You break down the managerial continuity of care. So if you feel like the elements of the care, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing, it's really traumatizing for people. So to make sure that we create this impression that there is continuity on those three levels, the relational, the informational, and the managerial continuity, because I know it's going to break down on one of the three at some point, right? And if we can rely on the other two to say, hey, no, we did know this. We just, you know, we had to catch up because there was this transfer of care. I'm trying to catch up with all the information. I'm your doctor. And again, being accessible and being available and being trustworthy means that patients will excuse those follies that you have, those little, I'll call them mistakes, even though they're not necessarily mistakes, but those gaps, we'll say, is probably the best yep. way to describe them. The gaps in continuity that may or may not have any impact on the outcome, but have a huge impact on the journey and on the experience of care that we were talking about at the very beginning.
Yeah, people will definitely latch on to something that is then suddenly making them question or feel unsafe. It doesn't take much to
shatter the confidence.
Join us next week for part two of this very special episode.
If you're a nurse or nursing student that enjoyed this episode, visit us at nurse.com/community,
where you can find the Nurse Dot discussion group, a place where we dissect each episode in detail and delve deeper into today's topics. Mm-hmm.
Nurse Dot is a Nurse.com original podcast series. Production, music, and sound editing by Dawn Lunsford. Production coordination by Rhea Wade. Additional editing by John Wells. Thank you to all the listeners for tuning in to the Nurse Dot podcast. Until next time, keep spreading the love and the care.